This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 29th, 2006. Filling in for Aldo Bogado, I'm Dante Tosa in Philadelphia.
I want everybody in America to know that we're not planning for a smaller New Orleans. We're planning for a bigger New Orleans.
The mayor talking about come back to New Orleans. But we don't have nothing to come back to New Orleans for. Where we gonna stay? Where we gonna live?
A lot of New Orleanians are very angry because what happened here was a man-made catastrophe. What happened to Mississippi was a natural disaster.
Across the country, people remember the devastation of Hurricane Katrina and look at the lessons learned in the storm's aftermath. We'll have reports from New Orleans and the nation's capital. After Jordan passed new anti-terror legislation this weekend, some Jordanians are calling it martial law. We'll have those stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. It's the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina today, an occasion authorities in Mississippi celebrated by reopening the MGM-owned Beau Rivage Casino in Biloxi. The entire 3.2 million square foot resort was rebuilt, including its casino, all of its 1,700 guest rooms and suites, restaurants, shops, kitchens, meeting rooms, luxury spas, and salons. Hundreds of residents protested the opening. Don Rojas is with the group Oxfam America.
Construction of the casino is actually displacing land that people of color, blacks and Vietnamese, owned or used to have their homes on that were destroyed. And the casinos are buying up all of the land in the adjacent areas. Now they're putting down, of course, shopping centers and everything that they need to feed the luxury hotels.
The Beau Rivage Casino was rebuilt with the help of generous public subsidies. But of the 60,000 families in Mississippi whose homes were destroyed by the hurricane, Don Rojas says only 30 have received cash from the government.
The government keeps saying, well, they're coming, the money's coming, the check's in the mail, just be patient. Well, here we are 1 year later, and there are thousands of people still living in these cramped trailers.
Don Rojas is with the group Oxfam America. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan continued his tour of areas in southern Lebanon devastated by the 34-day Israeli invasion, and then flew on to Jerusalem. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
Analysts say that UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's visit to Lebanon is a good faith move aimed at bolstering the truce between Hezbollah and Israel. Mr. Annan has put pressure on Israel to lift a 48-day air and sea blockade of Lebanon that the Lebanese government estimates has cost some $5.5 billion in trade. The BBC reports that Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz said the lifting of the blockade is imminent. Annan's tour of decimated villages in southern Lebanon came one day after he was harassed by residents of the southern Beirut neighborhood of Dahiyeh, scene of the conflict's worst urban devastation. Polls in Lebanon suggest that a wide cross-section of Lebanese see the UN as being complicit in allowing Israel to widen its military offensive over a 34-day period. Annan is meeting with Israeli officials this afternoon and tomorrow to discuss issues like the return of the two Israeli soldiers captured by Hezbollah on July 12th. After visiting Israel, Annan is set to travel to Iran and Syria, two countries that have close ties with Hezbollah. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
A key aide to Mexico's left-wing presidential candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, today demanded that the country's highest electoral authority annul last month's disputed elections. In an interview with the Financial Times, López Obrador's chief strategist said the tribunal has to annul the election because it is the only way out of Mexico's political crisis. The comments marked the first time López Obrador's Democratic Revolutionary Party, or PRD, has openly called for the election to be annulled. It came as Mexico's Federal Election Tribunal confirmed it would not order a full recount of votes cast on July 2nd. In its ruling, the tribunal rejected what until yesterday had been the chief demand of López Obrador, since the initial count put him slightly behind Felipe Calderón of the ruling center-right National Action Party. A four-member congressional delegation to Nepal is on its way back to Washington today. PC Duby reports from Kathmandu.
The head of the delegation, Republican Jim Kolbe of Arizona, said the armed Maoists were acting contrary to the peace agreement between them and the government. The congressional visit coincided with the U.S. government's decision to grant more than $30 million of aid to Nepal. The aid is designed to boost the development potential of the Himalayan kingdom and help it tide over the adverse repercussions caused by the Maoist insurgency. The U.S. aid had been on the rocks when the Nepalese ruling alliance indicated its willingness to share powers with armed Maoists last month. The U.S. is opposed to the inclusion of Maoists, whom it considers terrorists, in a legal government. But 2 weeks ago, Nepalese Premier Koirala paved the way for the aid package, declaring that there was no question of sharing powers with Maoists as long as they had arms on their soldiers. From Kathmandu, I'm P.C. Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff wants broader access to airline passenger records. In an op-ed in today's Washington Post, Chertoff asked for detailed information collected by airlines and travel agencies when a person books a flight. Those details, he said, would then be analyzed with government intelligence to identify so-called high-risk travelers before they board planes. Civil liberties groups are skeptical.
How much information do you need to know about somebody to prove that they're not a terrorist?
Jay Stanley is a privacy expert at the ACLU.
It's really a frightening road that they're trying to go down, which is trying to sift through everybody to try to find the unknown terrorist using personal information.
Meantime, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld today accused critics of the Bush administration's Iraq and counterterrorism policies of trying to appease a new type of fascism. Speaking before the American Legion, Rumsfeld compared the administration's critics to those who opposed confronting Adolf Hitler during World War II and said they suffer from moral and intellectual confusion about what threatens the nation's security and lack the courage to fight back. I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
The city of New Orleans marked the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina with commemorative events throughout the city today. While some grieve for the loss of loved ones, others are still demanding the return of basic services such as schools, hospitals, and in some places, electricity and running water, and the ability to return to the city. Christian Rosalind is in New Orleans.
Virginia Riso, Rebecca Roy, Nana Roberts, Arthur Robinson, Ethel Robinson.
For a city that dances at funerals, today was a somber day. Standing in the hot sun at the site of a levee breach in the lower Ninth Ward, survivors read the names of the more than 1,000 who died in flooding caused by the failure of the levee system during Hurricane Katrina.
Alberta Rocky,
Betty, Arsenal,
Edward Moray,
Mimi Thompson,
Robert Moran, Mary Moran, Ned Moreland.
The event in the lower Ninth Ward, organized by a coalition of groups including the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and the Neighborhood Empowerment Network, was one of dozens across the city in 3 days of commemorations. At a memorial to victims of the flood, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin vowed to rebuild the entire city.
I want everybody in America to know that we're not planning for a smaller New Orleans. We're planning for a bigger New Orleans. And as we plan for a bigger New Orleans, we're going to need every inch of this city. We plan to rebuild the lower Ninth Ward. We plan to rebuild the upper Ninth Ward. We plan to build every section of this city.
And while many events were marked by sorrow and grieving, there was an undercurrent of anger. At a memorial at the historic St. Augustine Church in the Treme neighborhood, Christine Berthoum stood silently with a sign made by the group levees.org, demanding that the Army Corps of Engineers be held accountable for what happened.
A lot of New Orleanians are very angry because what happened here was a man-made catastrophe. What happened to Mississippi was a natural disaster. What happened to New Orleans was a man-made disaster. It was through sheer negligence. Mismanagement, and I'm very angry about my beautiful city being destroyed because of that.
1 year later, the city of New Orleans is still largely in ruins. Not only are whole neighborhoods empty of the sounds of life, but in many places public services such as hospitals, schools, and even grocery stores have not been restored. Parts of the lower Ninth Ward are still without electricity and running water, which makes it so that residents cannot receive FEMA trailers. Patricia Jones of the Neighborhood Empowerment Network says this is keeping many from returning.
Right now, if you don't have anywhere to put your children, then why would you come here and stay? If you're not totally healthy, I wouldn't advise you to be in New Orleans. I hope that the only reason you had to go to the hospital is because you tripped on a nail and not because you did have the physical ailment pre-Katrina, because there are not enough services here to sustain you.
More than 200,000 people have still not come back to New Orleans. Some, like Eugene Jean-Pierre, are stranded in FEMA trailer parks with no access to transportation and with limited information on their city and their property.
They put us out there like if they just didn't forget about us. Don't have communication with New Orleans, like the mayor talking about come back to New Orleans. But we don't have nothing to come back to New Orleans for. Where are we going to stay? Where are we going to live?
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Christian Roseland in New Orleans.
As Tropical Storm Ernesto moved closer to Florida, Hurricane John is churning up waters near resort towns along Mexico's Pacific coast. The U.S. Hurricane Center said John, a Category 1 hurricane, could grow into a Category 3 strength by Wednesday. Coastal and mountain towns in the state of Guerrero have not yet been given the order to evacuate. A year ago, images of African Americans trapped in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina spurred national debates on race and equality. African Americans affected by the storm say they're still ignored by the government while struggling to piece their lives back together. Yang Mei Shui has the story.
If you're poor and if you're black, Katrina just hit yesterday.
Malik Rahim, co-founder of Common Ground Relief and a New Orleans native, speaks from his experience as a community activist at Lower Ninth Ward, a largely African American community.
We are still helping residents gut out their homes and provide the basics, respirators, Tyvek suits, rubber gloves and boots, basic tools so that residents can get their lives back together. But this shouldn't be the responsibility of no private organization without government support.
Government assistance is on the way, at least that's the message of President Bush, as he speaks in New Orleans on this first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
And a year ago, I made a pledge that we will learn the lessons of Katrina and that we will do what it takes to help you recover. I've come back to New Orleans to tell you the words that I spoke on Jackson Square are just as true today as they were then.
Rahim, however, is wary of such promises.
He's making plans and gonna make commitments, but commitments do not feed hungry babies. Commitments do not put roofs on people's houses. You know, it's action, and that's what is absent.
Today, more than 7% in New Orleans are jobless. But Rahim says African Americans take far greater a hit from unemployment than the average population.
Then in the African-American communities, in some segments, it was as high as 85%, where the only equal opportunity employer is the drug merchants. So people are his gaps into the only hope that they have.
Rahim is in Washington, D.C. today. His mission is to wake up the progressive community to situations in New Orleans. As to the government, he seems to have lost confidence. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For archives of this or any other newscast, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. U.S. Census reports reveal no change in income and poverty rates among Americans. The report also shows that the number of uninsured Americans has increased. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, this finding offers no good news for the poor in the United States.
Poverty is defined by the Office of Management and Budget as a person making an income of just under $10,000 per year, or a family of four making just under $20,000 per year. Nearly 13% of the population, or 37 million people, live in poverty. That's according to the annual statistics released by the U.S. Census Bureau. It's the first time the poverty rate has not risen in 4 years, the time when the last recession ended. Although the poverty rate has leveled off, 4 million more people live in poverty than did just 4 years ago.
The new data also show that the poor became poorer in 2005.
Robert Greenstein is executive director at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The number of people living in so-called extreme poverty, those who make half of what is considered poverty income, has risen. David Johnson is head of Housing and Household Economic Statistics at the Census Bureau.
In 2005, 43.1% of the poverty population lived with household incomes below 50% of their poverty threshold.
The age group most likely to be poor, children. 18% of children live in poverty, a rate that has remained unchanged since 2004. Blacks and Native Americans continue to have the highest poverty rate at 25% of their population. 20% of Latinos are poor, where 8% of whites. The state with the most people living in poverty is Mississippi, the state with the least, New Hampshire. As for income, David Johnson of the Census Bureau reveals,
"We can see that median household income rose in 2005. The last time real median income of households experienced an annual increase was in 1999.
Johnson says that this statistic, mixed with the stagnation of poverty rates, could result in the economic well-being of working households. But some economists dispute that claim. The actual income of workers fell more than 1.5%, or by $700 last year. How can median income rise and actual income fall? Well, Jared Bernstein of the Economic Policy Institute says,
"Median household income fell among working-age families, those headed by someone under 65. And in fact, as Bob has stressed, they've been falling consistently over the course of this recovery."
So the income of the elderly, those over 65, rose, which accounts for the overall increase of the median income. Blacks and Native Americans continue to have the lowest median income, followed by Latinos. And those who make the lowest saw income growth of less than 1%, where top wage earners saw growth at more than 3%. Women continue to make 77 cents to every dollar of their men counterparts. Christina Martin-Fravita, senior counsel with the National Women's Law Center, is concerned with the economic policies of the Bush administration.
"Our concern is that the economic policies that we've been following for the last several years are obviously not reaching middle-income and low-wage women and their families."
Furthermore, the number of uninsured rose to more than 46 million people. The increase comes from fewer employer-based insurance and independent coverage. The number of people on Medicare and Medicaid did increase. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
After about a month of negotiations, the government of Uganda and the Rebels Lords Resistant Army have signed an agreement for cessation of hostilities. The party said that the agreement demonstrated a dedication to finding a complete solution to the northern Uganda 20-year conflict. FSRN's Emmanuel Okella reports that the truce comes into effect Tuesday this week.
It was all smiles and ovation at the Jubaraha Hotel in southern Sudan on Saturday when leader of the Ugandan negotiation team, Dr. Ruhakana Rugunda, and that of the LRA, Martin Ojul, signed the 3-page accord. The parties agreed to cease all hostilities and military action against each other and any other act that may undermine the ongoing peace talks. The LRA has waged a 20-year conflict against the government of Uganda, accusing its president, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, of fueling tribalism and corruption. Thousands have died and millions fled their homes during the protracted conflict in the northern part of the country. The agreement shall, however, be renewed biweekly upon review of the progress of the peace talks in Juba and compliance by both parties. Leader of the Ugandan delegation, Dr. Ruhakana Rugunda, later told journalists in Kampala that a monitoring team is being instituted to ensure conformity by both parties.
The agreement provides that there will be a cessation of hostilities monitoring team. The tasks of the monitoring team are very well outlined, is to make sure that this team monitors the implementation of this agreement, makes sure that people who are assembling securely, they are provided with the necessary requirements. So the team will ensure that the agreement works well. What is the composition of the team? The government of Southern Sudan will provide the chair of this team, and the Lord's Resistance Army will have two people there. Government UPDF will have two people there, and the African Union will also have two people.
The government of Southern Sudan, assisted by selected humanitarian agencies, shall provide food and service support to the LRA at the assembly areas. Vice President of Southern Sudan, who is leading the mediation, has asked both President Museveni and the LRA leader Joseph Kony to effect the agreement by ordering their forces to hold fire. In his own words, Riek Machar said, "We hope the two principals should take action as soon as possible so that the guns shall be silent." The UPDF has agreed to give the rebels safe passage, but says it will not pull out from its positions. Ruth Nankabirwa is the State Minister for Defense.
The cessation of hostilities means agree to stop abducting children, stop laying ambushes, and UPDF stop chasing us. We will keep quiet where we will be, we will also be quiet. That does not mean that UPDF will withdraw from their point of deployment. No, they will be there. LRA will also be comfortable with Southern Sudan.
Previously, the government of Uganda had refused to halt hostilities before signing a comprehensive peace agreement, citing abuse of previous ceasefires by the rebels. Observers at the Juba peace talks and opposition leaders in Uganda lauded this latest development, saying the signing of a full peace deal by September 12th may now be a possibility. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Jordan's lower house of parliament approved a tougher anti-terrorism law that includes preventative detention of suspects, despite criticism by Islamists and human rights activists that it limits freedom of expressions. Uda Ferawati in Amman has more.
Authorities introduced the new bill to tighten current laws after last November's suicide bombings that killed 60 people, saying the country faced its biggest ever security challenge. Interior Minister Eid al-Fayez said that Islamist radicals are seeking to destabilize Jordan because of its pro-Western stance, and the new legislation covered loopholes in existing laws. Still, the government brushed aside the criticism by human rights activists and Islamist deputies who say the law is part of a crackdown on public freedoms and a pretext to suppress peaceful expression. Political analyst Jamal Tahat.
This law gives police and prosecutors wider powers against those who authorities say are merely suspected of plotting any acts of terror. Jordan has enough laws that can be used to try and prosecute those suspected of carrying or plotting terror acts like the Penal Code. We don't need such law.
The new law can prosecute people who express sympathy for suicide bombings and weakens safeguards to prevent people being detained without charge or trial for long periods without a judicial process. Even those who uphold views that may incite or encourage such attacks can be held responsible. Lawyer and political analyst Ghassan Mammar said that the authorities had, quote, wrong assumptions, end of quote, about terror and how to handle it.
All around the world, it has been proven with no doubt that it is not laws and regulations that will ever curb terror. Legislators have to look into the true reasons, the injustices that triggered terror and made it an international phenomenon.
In Amman, Jordan, I am Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
And now, from his cell on death row, journalist and commentator Momia Abu-Jamal.
Katrina, a year later. It is amazing the evocative power of one word, one name, Katrina. It resonates like a klaxon in the dark of night, an alarm that quickens the pulse, forces sweat from our armpits, and causes the heart to beat at a faster pace. It is as much name as it is nightmare, but it is more. It is revelation, the brief moment when lightning turns the night sky into brightest day, until the ears echo with the roar of thunder. For decades, at least since the high points of the civil rights movement or the heydays of the black liberation movement, U.S. blacks were able to live with the illusion that while things were far from perfect, they were getting better. We were, as the theme song of the Jeffersons went, moving on up to places of power, respect, prestige, and responsibility. There were hiccups, of course, but racism, that great dragon, Leviathan, was receding into its dark cave, perhaps for good. Then came Katrina. In a flash, in an hour, in a day, in a week, we saw with our own eyes the loss, the waste, the death, and perhaps worse, the dismissal of black life by virtually every agency of state power, local, state, and federal government, as well as other agencies, such as the media. For if the state was deadly by its ignoring of black suffering, the media was deadly by its poisonous attention and its perversion of the truth. The media gave the state license to ignore, to disappear, to downplay, and to discard black life. For in their twisted racist coverage, blacks were savages and thus unworthy of saving. If U.S. blacks had any illusions, the dark fetid waters of Katrina washed them away. Nationalism, citizenship, belonging to the white nation were lies. The waters of Katrina cleared the crust of sleep from our eyes and taught us that if you're black and poor, you're utterly on your own. With the death of this illusion of nationalism, we learned that we are Rwanda, we are Burundi, we are united in our blackness, our social isolation, our distancing from the very definition of humanity. We are them. A year has passed and disaster yet remains. Over half the city, over a quarter of a million people, have not returned to the Crescent City. The Lower Ninth Ward, the hub of black, poor, and working class New Orleanians, has neither running water nor electricity today. Between fighting the government and insurance companies, tens of thousands of people are still fighting for money to rebuild their homes and lives. Katrina, standing alone, is a beautiful name, but it may be many years before it stands alone again. For it is an event now of historic proportions that impacts all that flows from it, like a war, like a massacre, like a hurricane that transforms terrain, that shatters landscapes, that explodes myths of who we thought we were. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is a Workers' Wing collective. Simba Russo and Monica Lopez produce a newscast. Aaron Glantz is a headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is a Washington editor. Our technical production team in KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. For archives of this or any other newscast, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In Philadelphia, I'm Dante Tosa, sitting in for Alda Bogado.